knights and fair maidens, adventure and romance, triumph and tragedy, chivalry and villainy. These are the Middle Ages, and this is your gateway to the medieval world. I invite you to step back in time and experience All Things Medieval, the podcast dedicated to bringing you knowledge, tales, and insights into the Middle Ages of the past, the present, and of the future. Greetings, most noble lords and ladies, and welcome to episode 6 of the All Things Medieval podcast, which is the episode for the month of July. Now, we've skipped a month here along the line, so I was really hoping to get one out, but I've run horribly short of time, and although I'm still fairly pressed for time, I decided to dedicate some time to you, my loyal listeners, and put out this podcast. I really enjoy doing the podcasts, so I quite like them. I enjoy the feedback that I get. Sadly, I don't get nearly as much time as I'd like to dedicate to it. I'd really like to put one out once a week. That would be fantastic. And I have the gift of the gab enough, so to speak, about the Middle Ages that I could easily put one out once a week and not run short of material. I just love talking about the Middle Ages, just in case there's any new listeners out there who aren't aware of that. So, like I said, I'd like to put out two episodes in 1 month sometime soon. I was really hoping that it might have been June. Before that, I was really hoping it might have been May. Before then, I was hoping it was April, March, February, January, so on and so forth. At this stage, I don't think it's going to be July either, sadly, so hopefully I'll aim for something after July and try and get a couple of episodes out in 1 month, especially to make up for the missing one for June. So I've been really busy, as I've mentioned. I've been flat out. We've got the Abbey Medieval Festival coming up in a week and a half as of the time of this recording. The Abbey Medieval Festival, in case you haven't been listening to previous podcasts, is pretty much the biggest event in the Southern Hemisphere for reenactors and medieval performers. And it's an event which I'm at every year and take part in many different events there, ranging from equestrian to foot tournament to the grand finale and a whole bunch of other fun things in between. And other reenactments of different sorts of events, or recreations rather than reenactments of events, interpreted by reenactors from all over Australia and some from overseas as well. And we get in and we do what we love to do, and meet a lot of wonderful people, make a lot of new contacts, and usually spend more money than one really should in the marketplace. But overall, it's the event of the year for me, and it's the event of the year for many others as well. So I've been polishing harness furiously. I've been repairing pieces of harness and restitching things and making new things, unfurling the banners. A lot of these things, they're used throughout the year in my job as Sir Justin, the travelling knight for hire, so to speak. But it's really for the Abbey that I like to get things perfect. It's the biggest crowd that I perform in front of. And it's pretty much the time of year where I can showcase what I do. And that's, of course, with the group that I perform with called Elite de Corps. Elite de Corps, for anyone who may not know, is an old French term, which means pretty much the same thing as corps d'élite, which means the best in the chosen field. So it's a pretentious title. It was born pretty much from the willingness to want to pursue the lofty title and be the best out there in terms of performance and equipment and attitude and all the rest of that. But it also has another connotation from when Bertrand du Guesclin, it was the musician Guillaume de Machaut, who was in the court of King Jean of France, and that was King Jean Valois, and he said to him when King Jean decided to take on a whole bunch of troops, Guillaume de Machaut warned him and said to him, do not burden yourself with scum, take only picked men. So there's it has that sort of meaning to it as well, I suppose, rather than just taking anyone and everyone for the sake of quantity. We focus more on quality, and we're fairly selective with who we let into the group. It's pretty much a private affair, and as snobby as it does sound, it's primarily so we can keep control of what's going on, and so we can ensure that we are living up to our name, which is Elite de Corps, the best in a chosen field. So that's about it, really. I've been, aside from preparing, I've been absolutely busy with different shows. I do a lot of promotional events leading up to the Abbey Medieval Festival, as well as my normal events and shows at various private functions and at various public events and schools as well, and a few other different things here and there. All sorts of weird and wonderful things. Now, in fact, I've been so busy that I'm looking for an employee to help me out with the shows that I do. Now, if anyone's interested, and I mean anyone, even if you're from overseas, I'm willing to look into that if it's open for the person who is right for the job. So that doesn't really matter what country you're from, just so long as you can fit in with the whole theme of what I'm doing, and as long as you're a passionate individual that's willing to throw everything behind what you're doing 110% to make sure we can do the best performances that we can. So if you're looking for more information on that, head over to one of my websites, sirjustin.com, or to my MySpace page, and there's more details there. I'm accepting submissions by email at the moment, and once I sift through those, eventually I'll decide upon the next stage and contact the people who may be eligible for further screening and interviews. So you can get in touch with me here at the All Things Medieval podcast on the forums at www.sirjustin.com or by email at podcast@sirjustin.com. And hey, why don't you tell me what you've been doing in your medieval life, so to speak? Tell me you like the podcast, tell me you hate it, tell me how to improve it, and whatever feedback that you have, if you've got ideas, just get out there and let them be known, because I'm not going to know otherwise unless you contact me. Should be a fairly short show, this episode, because I don't have a lot of time to spare for it, so I will attempt to not digress or ramble or talk too much, and we'll get straight into the heart of the show.
Bringing you the latest happenings from across the kingdom, here comes the All Things Medieval Herald in the Herald's Call.
Thank you, Herald. Now you best be off on your next errand. There's no time to waste. The Abbey Medieval Festival swiftly approaches. So the first thing we've got in the Herald's Call news this episode is some exciting news for fans of the Normans and of the whole Battle of Hastings and all of its associated culture and time period. There's a movie coming out about King Harold II. You can check that out at it's a MySpace website, so you just go to myspace.com / Harold Godwinson. So it looks like it's going to be pretty cool too. I've had a quick look at the MySpace thing myself. I managed to they sent me an invite on the MySpace page, and I found out it about that way, and it looks like it's going to be fantastic. Looks like it's going to be terribly accurate in its depiction of clothing and armor and other such things, and I'm just really looking forward to it. There's going to be, I really feel that movies are starting to take heed of historical accuracy a little bit more, and they're trying to get things right, which I think is fantastic. So head on over there, that's myspace.com/ Harold Godwinson, and check out the movie about 1066. It might even be called 1066, but you'll find out when you get there. Looks great. Next piece of news is for music fans. The Medieval Babes, they're a band which have been an all-female band, which obviously, otherwise they may not be called Medieval Babes. Oh, I shouldn't be too sexist, I suppose, from a lady's point of view. Yeah, okay. So I take that back. But the Medieval Babes are indeed an all-female group who do a lot of traditional musical arrangements of medieval songs, really old folklore songs and things such as that. They're a fantastic band, and if you haven't heard them before, I'd recommend you head over to www.medievalbabes.com and check out their website and check out their discography as well. But the whole purpose of this point of this part of the news section is that they're bringing out a new album later in the year, so pretty exciting stuff. They haven't had one out for a little while, so, and it looks as though it will be released, as yet untitled, but it will be released later on in the year, so I'm really looking forward to that, and perhaps I can bring you a review on the album from my own perspective and point of view somewhere later on in the track in the marketplace section. Something else, while you're on the internet checking out those last two websites, go and have a look at the Living History Worldwide Forum and Facebook and MySpace thingy-majigamy over at skirmishmagazine.ning.com. Now, it's an awesome forum for living history enthusiasts. So mostly reenactors on there by the looks of it. Covers a huge range of time periods. It's pretty much anything. If it's history, it's on there. So go over and have a look at that. Sign up, start up a profile. I've got a profile over there myself. So do a bit of a search for Sir Justin, and let's hook up on the internet. And for that matter, if you're on MySpace, let's do that as well. Sounds good to me. Okay, Time Team plans to visit, this is going to be tricky to pronounce, it's spelt L-O-O-E, Louis Island, or Lou Island, which is, well, we'll get into it and then I'll request some help on that. England's favourite archaeology filmmakers are planning to visit Lou to uncover the history of a derelict chapel. Channel 4's Time Team has expressed an interest in going to St George's Island at the end of May to excavate a Benedictine chapel which dates back to 1139. Can someone please kindly direct me to a site where I can pronounce that correctly, or can someone actually send me an email and tell me how that's pronounced? But it's spelled L-O-O-E. Haven't heard of it before myself, but I am going to look up further on it now. So we have news about another movie, this one by Universal Pictures. Now, for people who really like their historically accurate movies, you may wish to skip this part of the podcast. I'm only guessing, so I shouldn't be presumptuous. But a film called The Knights Templar is in the making. It's a medieval horror movie. Sounds interesting. The famed knights must defend the Holy Grail from a horde of vampires. Knights versus vampires. Sounds kind of cool to me. Russian Timber... Oh, wow. Okay, I'm going to have a go at this. Russian Timber Bekmambetov of Daywatch, Nightwatch and Wanted fame will share the role of producer with Mark Platt, with a script by Adam Torchia and Justin Stanley, who are said to be historians as well as aspiring screenwriters. So, well, hopefully that's going to be... that sounds like a really interesting mix, and I'll watch it myself regardless. I'm not one to put much faith in reviews. Reviewers often, if they say it's terrible, generally I like it, and if they say it's fantastic, generally I dislike it. Not being contrary, it just seems to be the way that it goes. So... yeah, I'd be interested in checking that out and having a look. If anyone knows anything else about that, that would be fantastic if you could contact us here at the podcast and let us know. Next piece of exciting news is a medieval ship was found under a car park in Barcelona. Construction of an underground parking lot in Barcelona, in a Barcelona neighbourhood that was under the sea in the Middle Ages, has uncovered a ship that sank, according to archaeologists supervising the site, in the 13th or 14th century. The ship's remains are at some 7 metres or 23 feet below sea level, where construction workers found the upside-down wooden hull of a ship that capsized and sank off what was then the coast of the Catalonian capital. Experts say that the ship's design indicates that it came from somewhere on the Atlantic Ocean. Sounds pretty interesting, and I'll try to find out more about that and report on that in future episodes. This news piece is about another podcast called Chivalry Today at chivalrytoday.com by Scott Farrell. If you like this podcast, then you should check it out. It talks about chivalry and its many facets, including the past and how it is still relevant today. It's filled with interviews with interesting folk from all walks of life who have something to say about chivalry. Scott also has a wonderful talent for finding chivalric value in movies, books, and everyday life. If you love the culture of chivalry, you'll love this podcast. And I might also add that the podcast is a very high quality, very professional program that's put together by Scott. And, well, it's very inspiring for amateurs such as myself. And while we're on the subject of podcasts and you're busy checking your favourite podcatcher for the last podcast, have a look for the Celtic Myth Pod Show as well. It's a really cool podcast which, obviously, by the title of it, tells you ancient tales and legends of the Celts. So that includes, according to their website, Ireland, Scotland, Wales, Cornwall, Brittany and the Isle of Man. And they talk about pretty much all of the gods and the goddesses and the old Celtic tales and other mythology such as that, battles, sagas and the different heroes and heroines of that particular culture. I know it's way before the time period that we aspire to stick within, but I think it's still relevant, and I think that someone that enjoys things medieval would certainly find something worthwhile in the Celtic Myth Pod Show as well. I've had a listen to it. It sounds pretty cool. It's another podcast which I can look up to, and hope to one day sound like in terms of sound quality and things such as that. But so check those two podcasts out. I really think that they're worthwhile for listeners. If they weren't worthwhile, then I wouldn't even mention them on the show. So I'd recommend checking them out. And you can find the Celtic Myth Pod Show over at CelticMythPodShow.com, or just if you're on iTunes, hop on over to iTunes and type in a search in the iTunes store for Celtic Myth Pod Show. And that concludes the news for this episode, and we'll move on to an outdated event section.
Come one, come all, lords and ladies, fellow countrymen and women, gather around and hear all about exciting events, fairs and tournaments coming soon to our fair lands.
This podcast has been recorded in two parts this month. As we reach this section of the show, 2 or 3 weeks have passed since I first started recording it. As a result, some of the events I'm mentioning have been and gone. For this I apologise, but would like to mention them anyway so that people can be aware that they've been on and they will likely be on once again. The first one, of course, I've mentioned it a few times, is Gen Con Oz. Again, it's not a medieval event, but there's a lot of common interests between gamers and between medieval enthusiasts. And apparently it went fairly well. It attracted several thousand visitors over the weekend, and from what I hear, it will be returning again next year, but this time it will probably be in September, so more news on that as it becomes evident. The Abbey Medieval Festival, of course, has been and gone, and it attracted an estimated 17,000 visitors this year. And if you're interested in seeing some of the pics of the event, head on over to abbeypics.com to see some photography by Mark Greenmantle and his official Abbey photography team. There's a lot of great shots there abounding, showcasing the reenactors and performers who attended the event. If you missed out this time around, then start planning for next year. It will be the 20th anniversary of the event, and it promises to be huge. It will be on during the 4th of July until the 12th of July, with the two-day tournament itself being on the 10th and the 11th of July. I do hope to see you all there. Aaron from New York State in the United States sent me an email some time ago to tell me about his favourite festival in the Northeast United States of America. It's Sterling Festival, and you can find that at sterlingfestival.com. This festival runs on weekends from July 12th till the 17th of August, so it is actually still running. I do apologise to you, Aaron, for not getting the details of this event up on the podcast until after the commencement of the event itself. But for those of you in the area, it's not too late, and I'd get along. There's still 3 or 4 weekends left of that particular event, so I'd get along and have a look-see at that, and love to hear some more about it. And to make up for a very sparse events segment for this episode, I'm going to go to the latest issue of Renaissance magazine, and at random I'm going to pick out an event. This one is in the United States of America, Pennsylvania, and it is the Pittsburgh Renaissance Festival from August 23rd to September 28th. Information I have in front of me, admission is $14.95, I imagine that's US dollars. And it's the website for more information is www.pittsburghrenfest.com. I'd love for anyone who attends that one to actually get in touch with me and let me know how it all went. And that's about it for events this month. I promise to have a few more next month. I'll have, well, next episode. It will be a lot sooner than this last episode. And hopefully have some cool news and events for you guys.
And now it's time for the All Things Medieval podcast main feature. Listen to discourse and interviews where we talk about a featured topic or chat with a special guest.
Well, you would think with the amount of events that I've been attending and how busy I've been and the people I've been in touch with during that time, you would think that I would have another interview lined up and be able to have someone else on the show to talk about different things, discussing their knowledge and expertise on different matters. You would be well justified in thinking that, but you would probably be a tad foolish in thinking that's what's actually happened. So I actually don't have any interviews for you this month. What I am going to do, though, is do a bit of a discussion about medieval combat. Now, when I say discussion, as always, this is just my take on matters, so it's my personal opinion. I'm always interested to hear other opinions because quite often my opinion is not correct. It's only as correct as what I can get it from my current perspective based on my current knowledge, and perspectives and knowledge changes so radically and so often. It's really good just to keep readjusting, keep an open mind, and just pretty much always learn things. History is never written in absolutes, or rather I should say essays or discussions or books about history are never in absolutes, or we should never consider them to be in absolutes. So without any further rambling about that particular part, I might talk a little bit about, you might stop and think, what kind of credentials do you have to speak about medieval combat in any sort of authoritative manner? And, well, I guess you would be right in asking that. Now, I guess you could ask what sort of credentials does anyone have, really? A lot of people come from a martial arts background, but we can't really take martial arts and apply that to medieval combat. It's a different society. Fighting and combat has a different context today to many of us, unless you're in the actual military. And even if you are in the military today, it's a radically different thing to what it was back in the Middle Ages. So I tend to think that, I've had a background in martial arts ever since I was a young lad, but I don't tend to, what I've known about martial arts doesn't really apply, as far as I'm concerned, to medieval combat, or hardly even to theatrical or reenactment combat, or even to, maybe a little bit to Western martial arts. It's kind of the same sort of thing, but we'll talk about that a little bit later. So other credentials, aside from the martial arts experience, for many, many years, I was actually a bouncer in our New South Wales in Queensland at various hotels and nightclubs. When I was a young miscreant, I used to get involved in a lot of, urban combat, I think might be the best way to put it. I'm glad those days are behind me. So other than that, really, I've got nothing except to say that I've been doing reenactment fighting for about 10 years now, and reenactment fighting again is actually no reflection whatsoever on real combat. So really, I've got nothing. I've read a lot of books, but I'm sure a lot of other listeners have read a lot of books, and I'm sure a lot of listeners have had very similar experiences to what I have, and there's probably a whole bunch of other listeners that have actually had experience in the armed forces, or perhaps in police forces and other like-minded or other similar sort of jobs. So really, you're going to have to take this with a pinch of salt. What I can say with confidence is that I have spent a lot of time thinking about combat. I have spent a lot of time studying it and trying to get my head around the medieval soldier and the medieval knight to really sort of work out what was going on in their heads as much as we can today. Now, to do that, you can't take things from the modern world and apply it to the medieval world. What you have to do is pretty much immerse yourself in their culture or at least the study of it, the study of their culture, their society, their general way of life, their way of thinking, their origins, and just a whole bunch of different things like that. So there's a whole lot of things that go into the makeup of a medieval person, and as a result, a whole lot of things that goes into medieval combat. So that's pretty much the introduction to the feature. I think what we might discuss now is the objective of combat. Now, I'm pretty sure over the years I've managed to come up with a fairly short summary of what the objective of medieval combat was, and it's probably not much different to what combat is today. So I believe the objective of medieval combat was pretty much... Now, when I say medieval combat, I guess I'm thinking not so much of masses of armed forces, but one individual locked into mortal conflict with another. So that could be in the context of a street brawl. It could be in the context of being on a battlefield where it's one-on-one or something like that. So I think the objective within that context is to either kill or incapacitate your opponent as quickly and as efficiently as you can, whilst maintaining your own safety and health. So I think that's the overall objective. It's to kill the other guy as quick as you can without getting hurt and move on to the next one. So obviously that's the most immediate objective of a fight in the Middle Ages, or of a fight in any age, really. So where we go from there is obviously there could be... There's a grander battle going on. So within the grander scheme of that battle, the objective may be something to be able to defeat the enemy army. We'll talk on a very basic level. So in order to obtain that objective, you've really got to be able to kill the other guy while staying alive yourself. So the more people that are doing that, the better the result or the better chance you have of success in your main objective. So when we talk about that, we often think about, like, some of the myths that we have is that medieval combat was really, really clumsy or really savage very unsubtle. We picture it as it's pretty much just a hack and a bash kind of thing until the other fella falls down. We imagine there's no finesse whatsoever. But that is a common myth. There was actually a very structured way to fight, and it can actually be, or could actually be, I'd imagine, as you see in modern reenactment fighting today, it could actually be very elegant. As elegant as a battle could be when you're knee-deep in corpses and dead horses and screaming men and blood flying everywhere and bones crunching and limbs being broken and skulls being caved in, as elegant as you can get in that situation. I guess what I mean to say is it indeed was a martial art. It wasn't just a crude bash 'em up, let's get in and might makes right kind of thing. So there are a lot of tactics involved, on the grand scale of things to the smaller units, to even one man fighting against another man. There's certain tactics and certain there is a certain art to it, rather than just sort of jump in there and swing wildly and hope you hit the other guy before he hits you. It's not very conducive to the overall objective, which is to kill the other guy as quick as you can without being hurt yourself. You might ask what elements go into obtaining said objective. Well, there's a few elements. The most important ones, we'll have a look at them. Training. That's very, very important. Training can mean the difference between life and death. You can imagine if we get John the Farmer and we throw him out on the battlefield, and imagine he's had very little training, possibly none at all. Maybe if he's lucky, he's had some sort of rudimentary militia training or something like that, or possibly he's had a go at archery, especially if he's English in the 13th and 14th centuries, and we throw him out on the battlefield. Now, what he's likely to encounter, if he's unlucky, he may come across hand-to-hand combat. So that's if he's an archer. If he's a levied militia peasant, there's every chance he's going to come across hand-to-hand combat. Now, he might come across a trained soldier. So this soldier is someone who's retained in a household, so he's retained by nobles, and they practice fighting, they practice their drills, and they maintain their armour and equipment to a certain standard, and these people are, they somewhat have more of an advantage. Then he may come across a professional soldier, someone who's out campaigning on a fairly regular basis. When they're not campaigning, they're looking for a new employer or looking for a new war. So and someone else they might come across, if they're really unlucky, is a trained knight or nobleman. Now, these men were trained pretty much from a very, very young age. They were groomed pretty much from the time they could walk to see whether they'd be suitable for battle. So they're pretty much born and bred for combat. They have the best of everything. And so you can imagine if poor old John the Farmer encounters any of these three particular individuals in a one-on-one fight, or even if there was John and his buddy Ben the Farmer, you know, even the two of them would struggle to be able to overcome one of these individuals on the battlefield. So training plays a very, very important part in a medieval combat. The next thing is equipment. You can imagine John the Farmer, he may have some clothing. If he's lucky, he may have a padded jack or gambeson or ackerton, which is padded or quilted armour. So he'll be armed in that way. Maybe he'll have a dagger. He'll probably have some sort of farming implement which he's using as a tool. And he'll be up against men. Let's look at our retained soldier. Our retained soldier may have some form of body armour. He would have more than likely have some form of military weapon, and he may have a steel helm or a coif or something else like that. Now, if we look at our professional soldier is almost definitely going to have some sort of helm. He's pretty much going to have some body armour. He may even have some armour for his limbs as well. And he's going to be fairly well armed himself. And finally, if we look at our men-at-arms, our squires and knights, our heavy cavalry, they're going to be clad in armour head to toe. They're going to be armed to the teeth, and they're also going to have a war horse which is trained for battle as well. So you can imagine his life expectancy so far, based on his training and his equipment, unless he's part of a greater plan or something, his life expectancy, especially in a one-on-one fight on the battlefield against one of these soldiers, is going to be very, very short. So he's not going to obtain his goal very well whatsoever. However, the other men, they're much more adept. They've had better training, they've got better equipment, their life expectancy is great, and their expectancy to, or their chances of being able to slay an opponent fairly high as well. So we'll move on to something else which plays a part, and of course that's pretty much chance, luck, or if you're living in the Middle Ages, the will of God. So that plays a big part as well, the element of chaos and the element of chance, so to speak, on any battlefield is something which can pretty much strike the lowliest peasant, and it can strike the most regal and most successful king, and in an instant rob them of their life or elevate them to becoming heroes, all on the whims, the flow and the tide of the chaos of battle. So that's something else that plays an important part. And I believe it's those three things which are probably the three main elements in determining a victor and a loser in a one-on-one fight. Of course, there's certain environmental issues or tactical issues which we can bring into play, but when it comes down to a single man fighting for his life against another man, generally that's what it's going to come down to, is one of those three things. So we'll briefly talk about equipment again. Something that I forgot to mention is, you can imagine a man who's not wearing a helm, he would only have to take a slight blow to the head from any kind of weapon to pretty much put him out of action, to incapacitate him or to kill him. Now, a man who's wearing a helm is going to be able to, he'll be able to take a bit more of a blow. If a man, such as a man-at-arms, is wearing a very stout, well-crafted helm, which is custom-made to fit him, and that has, it's well-padded and pretty much covers his whole face, he can lead with his face if he so chooses. I wouldn't recommend it, and they probably didn't either, but he can take some fairly stout blows to the head and still be able to deal some damage straight back out to his opponent. The armour was very much, we often think of armour, and a lot of it's got to do, I think, with movies and with reenactment combat, we see the armour playing a passive role in many combats in our day and age. That's to say that if a blow's coming in, people are trying to avoid it. They're trying not to get their armour mashed up too much because, especially in reenactment combat, a strike to the head or a strike to the limb or something, pretty much it can wreck the armour as well as put you out of the fight. But in an actual real medieval combat, this armour did its job beautifully well. So you could actually deflect blows with the armour, and quite often, I would imagine, we see no great record of it. But just through my experience with weapons and with armour and such, I fully believe that they would have used that armour not so much, well, almost aggressively, I dare say. It would have been something which they would have relied on heavily. They would have known what the armour was capable of protecting against, and therefore possibly deflected or parried blows with their limbs and with their armour. So it's something they may judge, well, I may be able to take this blow on the limb, or I may be able to skip this blow off the helm or something like that. And I'll risk taking a hit such as that to be able to really be able to deliver my opponent a devastating blow. One fourth element that I might add into that, which we've more or less covered in a roundabout way in the other elements, but the fourth element is experience. So you can pretty much take a man who's been in 10, 20 battles or engagements against an enemy, put him against some people that are green to it, and he's going to know pretty much every trick in the book. He's going to be aware of what could be going through their heads. He's going to be aware of what they're capable of or what they might not be expecting, and different things like that. So. And the same would apply for the man who's never been out on the battlefield before. So you can imagine as much training as someone can have, they can never learn as much as what they can in with the practical application of said training. So, and that applies to almost anything you apply yourself to in terms of training. So it could be if you're a chef, you can practice all you like, but until you actually have a practical application of working with the public, working in a professional kitchen, then you're not going to have that full experience. Anyone who's ever done martial arts or sport for that matter would have to agree that you can do all the training in the world, but on the day when it comes to the actual event taking place, it's mentally different and it's physically different, and there's so many other things which you've never really taken into account. So, and it applies to absolutely everything and anything. I mean, it's just a fact of life. So you can imagine that these men, however highly trained they might be, unless they've actually been in a couple of battles and they need to survive those few battles, they need to really get in there and find out what it's all about. Until they've done that, they're actually missing a facet of which rounds out their ability to be able to perform their duty correctly. And now you might be wondering, how exactly does all this come together on the battlefield? I mean, it sounds fairly straightforward, but let's go over it a little bit. Well, the application of these elements and the combat, what was it really like? Is it like the movies? I think a lot of movies these days that are coming out are fairly accurate in their depiction of some combat scenes. The movies The Lord of the Rings were actually, the fighting was pretty good in that and fairly accurate. You can... And some of the other movies, Kingdom of Heaven, yeah, that was kind of accurate as well, except when the hero of the movie lost his helm and his hair's gallantly swishing about in the wind and looking very striking and what have you. That's absolutely bloody crazy. If you lost a helm in combat, or rather, I think in the movie he actually removed the helm or removed his coif or something or other, that is absolutely mental. There is no way you would do that. And we discussed the reasons why, just the slightest blow to the skull could pretty much render you either dead or in desperate need of some headache tablets. So that kind of the movies, they're not too bad, but okay, so what was it really like? We can never really know for certain. You know, it's something which we can only sort of study, look at, and pretty much make a determination on it. But I think it can come down to something like this. Now, I'm talking about the application, not the whole battlefield experience, but the application of all those elements that we've that we've spoken about. Now, I've already mentioned the armor. I probably should have saved the armor for this part, but we've already mentioned how you're going to rely heavily on the armor that you have to be able to carry you through and be able to bring you to safety. So we might have a look at the weapons now. You're going to take a weapon that you're pretty much the most comfortable with, as in the most skilled with, a weapon which you've probably had a natural skill with. So you, even though you're going to be trained with as many weapons as possible, ideally you are anyway, you're going to take something which you're most familiar with. For John the Farmer, that could be something like the axe he uses to chop wood, or it could be the flail he uses to thresh the wheat. So they're items which are familiar to him. He's comfortable using them. He understands the balance of them. He understands their function. So he's going to take them onto the battlefield. For the soldier and the knight, they're going to take the weapons that they feel more comfortable with. And pretty much also they're going to take weapons, especially the soldiers, that complement their companions. So, or rather, there's going to be a healthy mix of weapons which can help you get the job done as well. So they're pretty much, they're all things that they're comfortable with, and that's for two reasons I believe they would have done this. One, it improves their life expectancy, their chances of survival, and two, it makes them more able to perform their duty at the best of their potential ability. So I think you're pretty much going to stick with what you know, because it's going to save your neck in the end and save the neck of your companions. So on the battlefield, what you're going to be doing in a one-on-one fight, you're pretty much going to be judging against whom you're fighting, what sort of weapon they're using. Now, skill plays a lot, or comes into effect a lot, in a one-on-one fight. But you can have the most skilled swordsman in the world, and if he hasn't got adequate armor, or if his opponent has superior armor, then pretty much you can guarantee he only has to take a slight wound to be able to finish him off, and that gentleman who's wearing the superior armor is going to come out triumphant. Armor can make or break a man. It's pretty much one of the big factors in a combat situation as to who's going to determine who's going to come out on top. Now, I once read it was really interesting, and I believe the book called The Peel Affinity has a picture of this, and they actually mentioned something about it. But a chronicler once wrote that foot soldiers or the lesser armoured men would circle a man at arms if they could break him away from a main group, and they would attack him in the way that a wolf attacks a bear. Now, let's put this into perspective. You can imagine these guys, they don't want to just fly in and go full force with this, with the bear, for example. If we talk about wolves and bears, what the wolves are going to do is launch small harrowing attacks to hopefully distract, so someone else can come in and land another small wound, and they're going to keep doing that until eventually the bear wears down, until eventually the bear's lost blood, or he's suffered enough wounds, or until he loses his balance or makes that one error which allows the pack to swarm him and take him out. However, the pack would only have to suffer a couple of losses until they determine, this battle is certainly not going our way, let's pull back. Now, you can imagine the bear is pretty much going to devastate a wolf if he manages to get hold of it, if he can maul it, or if he can strike it fairly heavily. He can pretty much incapacitate or kill with one blow. Pretty much the same sort of thing with our men-at-arms against our lesser armoured soldiers, and also against our levied troops. Now, skill plays a big part in it, as we've mentioned. You can imagine the poor old farmer who comes across the knight on the battlefield. He's not going to last long at all, and that comes down, even if they were equally armoured, that chances are the knight would prevail in that situation, unless, of course, chance took its turn and you know, played out in favour of the farmer. But 9 times out of 10, the knight is going to defeat the farmer. Even if they were equally armoured, the knight will emerge victorious after the combat. It's pretty much the same sort of thing if we take an amateur sportsman and compare him against a professional sportsman. Chances are, I mean, you could pretty much lay money each and every time that professional sportsman is going to he's going to be victorious. Now, that certainly that's not always the given case. That does not always ring true. And if we look at the laws of averages, pretty much that's how it's going to work. A closer simile would be our modern professionally trained soldier coming up against a reserve army soldier or a state trooper or something like that. Generally, that professional soldier, he's going to come out on top. Even with the same sort of equipment, he's going to have better training, he's going to have better knowledge, he's probably going to have more experiences. So chances are he is going to come out on top of a hand-to-hand combat encounter. My overall thoughts on the application of the combat or how it would look taking place, I really don't think it would be as in the movies, as we mentioned, or in literature it's depicted as might makes right, just a good hack and bash. I really don't think that would be the way it would work. To a certain degree it would, but also I think a lot of the time what's going to come into effect is the training, the experience and the equipment, as we've mentioned, and chance. So the way it's going to look is it's going to be more of a calculated fight. It's not just going to be swing wildly and just madly and go berserk and until you go mad. I mean, some people might grimace at this, but I'd prefer if you grimaced on your own, because I'm a big fan of the Conan movies, and if you have a look at those particular movies, for example, and this is really, really lame considering I'm comparing a fantasy movie, Hollywood movie, to real medieval combat, but in those battles, Conan never sort of, that is really lame, forget that, let's not do that at all. Okay, pretty much the combat is, you're not going to throw yourself into a berserker's rage for a couple of reasons, because generally if you have gone into a berserker's rage, it's probably because you're fearful or possibly you've become overwhelmed in some way. Chances are you're going, or perhaps you're affected by some sort of some mushroom-like concoction, as they believe that the Viking berserkers were. So the reason that you're doing that is because your emotions have run at a very high level. Now, they've pretty much you've blown your stack in one way or another. Your fragile little mind has become broken, and you've gone into a rage. Now, that's really disadvantageous, pretty much because it's going to tire you out fairly quickly. Secondly, it's going to be hard for you to make any kind of rational decision. Now, you've got to maintain a cool head in every situation that you come across. So even when you think you may be dying, you can imagine these men who have been acclimatized to battle from a very young age, like such as our knights. You can imagine that no matter what's going on, they're still keeping fairly calm, they're still retaining their self-control and their self-discipline. Like any soldier in any engagement, that they've got to maintain that discipline, and they have to pretty much focus on the task at hand. They have to fight through whatever pain they may have suffered, whatever discomfort. They have to just push on through the boundaries of pain, fatigue, exhaustion, mental boundaries of having your friends, companions, loved ones cut down. You have to be able to put all that aside, maintain that level head, and be able to continue on. Now, can you imagine poor old John the Farmer trying to be able to do that? I mean, it's going to be a fair task for him, especially if he's never seen battle before. But if we look at our knights who have probably, they've probably seen their friends and their family die in combat and had to be able to cope with that for whatever reason. So you can imagine that the chances of these men overcoming the others are, they're fairly high, of the more experienced, the more disciplined man. Now, we might talk, this is a really exhaustive topic. You know, I'm going to hopefully address this later on in a few more shows and talk about it in depth a little bit more. But I just really want to dispel this myth, I guess, is the purpose of this segment, dispel the myth that medieval combat was just this random, chaotic, crazy thing that had no, you know, you didn't have to be skilled, you just had to be strong and just swing a big heavy sword and kill the man and just keep chopping people until they're, it's not quite like that whatsoever. So that's pretty much what I'm trying to do with that. So I think that was, that's kind of it in a nutshell, but I'm still left wanting, and possibly listeners are still left wanting as well. So, and because I'm starting to get a little incohesive, because I'm getting confused with trying to put my thoughts out in audio, we'll move on to something that I do know a fair bit about, and that's modern fighting, such as reenactment and Western martial arts. So we'll talk about that for a little while. Now, there's a certain circle of or a certain breed of reenactor or Western martial artist who they're a little bit odd in that they believe that what they're doing is as close to real medieval combat as you can get, and possibly it is. But let's look at that in detail for a moment, shall we? If we remember the objective of medieval combat, it is to incapacitate or kill your opponent as quickly as you can while maintaining your own safety. Now let's look at the main objective of reenactment combat. Do we see a problem here? Yes. Okay, now the main objective is to be able to pretty much maintain your own safety, maintain your opponent's safety, while adhering to the rules which pretty much generate what we call a kill or a victory in combat. Now, because the very fundamental objective is so radically different, we can't therefore say that that reenactment fighting or even Western martial arts tournaments are an accurate depiction of medieval combat. What we can say, however, is that it is a fairly accurate, a facsimile of what their training may have been like. So if you look at it in that way, I mean, a lot of reenactment fighting, you see blows are pulled. Even in Western martial arts fighting, a lot of blows that they do, they actually pull the blows up, or they're wearing gear which is so ridiculously protective that it can hinder your movement or your vision or perspective, or even where the strike might stop, such as the big face masks, that the fencing masks that you see some people wear. You can imagine that a strike to that, it's going to be different than if you were actually striking the face. So really, they're vastly different. So don't let anyone ever tell you that, this fighting that we do, it's the closest that you can get to the real thing, Well, I guess they could be right, as I mentioned in saying that, but really, essentially, they are two radically different, radically different objectives. So you can't sort of apply that in that sort of situation. Now, there are some things you can apply. Some things which do apply are chance, of course. So there's many a combat which I've lost through dumb luck. There's many a combat which I've won through dumb luck as well. You can put it down to training as well. You can imagine the person who's been training frequently or experienced in a lot of tournaments is actually going to probably be a lot more successful than the new guy or the person who hasn't been training much. And finally, we can look at equipment as well. Equipment doesn't play as much of a role because we're actually not using the equipment to its full capacity, and that's how I'm talking both weapons and talking armor as well. In a lot of reenactment combat, to take a blow to the head, pretty much it's considered a killing blow, regardless of how hard the blow may have struck or whether the blow had glanced off or what have you. It's pretty much considered a finishing blow, and so you have to concede defeat and wait for your next bout, pretty much, and let the other guy continue on. So something else which I might address is fitness in reenactment fighting. Now, I'm going to get up on my soapbox a little bit here again. Now, if I feel that if a combatant is going to be any way representing an accurate picture of the past, then I think that said combatant should maintain a certain level of fitness and training, not to mention equipment as well. If you're doing it privately, if you're more of a hobby group, if you're not, or if you're out there and you're saying, this is a theatrical performance rather than an accurate historical performance, I don't think it's a problem. It's not an issue. But the moment you start saying that you're living history, or that you're reenacting combats and combatants of a bygone age, then I really think you should probably lose your beer gut, and you should probably do something about self-discipline, in the sense that you're going to spend some time training, becoming familiar with your weapons, familiar with your armor or with your harness, different things like that, if you're going to go out there and represent to the public what medieval combat was and what the people who engaged in it, what they looked like and how they performed. So now, I'm not just picking on the people who are overweight as well, and you all know who you are, and I'm not just picking on the people who don't train nearly enough, and you all know who you are as well, but who I'm also picking on, or who I'm also addressing, are the people that are not mentally fit for this kind of rigorous activity. And you come across a lot of people that are like that. You come across a lot of people that are a little bit imbalanced in the way that I guess they're a little bit crazy, I suppose. Now, that was probably very accurate for some people, I guess. But if we look at, in the Middle Ages, I mean, but if we look at our knights specifically, they were probably a whole lot more disciplined than that. And most people that are portraying reenactment combat are portraying the knightly class. So something else I think we've got to look at as well in terms of our psychological preparation is you get a lot of people who are not, you know, they're not, I guess, they're a little bit more gentle souls, and they're out there and they're portraying these warrior classes, these professional warriors, and they're out there and they, you know, for whatever reason, they might take a hit and then can't go on, and it's not through injury, it's just through sheer, they're a little bit fearful, or people that won't fully engage in combat because they're fearful as well. Or you have people who, you know, will moan and complain about the slightest sort of hit that they take. Now, those sort of people shouldn't be out there either. I'm not suggesting that medieval reenactment combat or Western martial arts combat should be as dangerous as the historical stuff. But, I mean, people that are going out there onto the tournament field, they've got a good idea that, well, you know, there's people swinging at their heads with axes, swords. They're getting thrust in the abdomen, in the chest, with lances. So there's an element of risk, do you think? You know, so just keep that in mind. I think that, so people that are not mentally fit and people that are not physically fit, whether they're, you know, whether they're not very strong in the body or whether they're overweight in the body, I don't think these people should be out there representing historical combat to a public audience. It gives the wrong impression, and it helps to create a whole lot of myths which shouldn't really be there. It helps to support myths as well. Now, is that to say there were never any unfit combatants? Now, when I say unfit, I'm saying physically unfit and mentally unfit. Is that to say there were never any unfit combatants? No, not at all. Were they the norm? Well, no, they would not have been. And we look at chronicles, we look at art from the Middle Ages, and we look at all sorts of different things like that, and we can determine that our warriors, from the lowliest archer or soldier up to the most highly trained and highly prized knight or champion, were pretty much lean, mean fighting machines, okay? And that's what we need to be able to recreate if we're meant to be doing an authentic and, you know, a true representation of medieval combat to the public today. Now, how might you ask, does one become knowledgeable and well-versed in the art of medieval combat, in what it may have really been like? And you know, well, yeah, we'll start with that. Okay, so how do you become learned in that? I think there's a few different things you need to do. You need to get involved in some sort of sword play. Okay, so it can be something just like, for starters, we'll say sports fencing, although radically different from real combat today in this day and age, still gives you some sort of appreciation of a weapon and what it's capable of doing. Probably more so than that, I would recommend that you get involved in reenactment and you get involved in Western martial arts. Now, to a lot of people, you might wonder what the difference is. Just do a search for Western martial arts and do a search for reenactment combat, and you'll probably come across some of the forums where you have reenactors and Western martial artists at each other's throat about whose style is best and whose is more accurate and whose is the most truest form, and it's absolutely bloody crazy. So ignore all that, find a reenactment group and find a Western martial arts group. Try them both together because you're going to learn from both. That's not to say combine them and create a whole new style, but certainly experience both of these things. Okay, now you need to go out and you need to apply this in combat situations, whether it's tournament fighting through Western martial arts groups, or whether it's reenactment fighting, or even theatrical fighting to an extent. I think you really need to look at all these things as a whole and sort of get your head around it. Now, what you're not going to understand is, or what you're going to fail to understand is the context and the culture of the people who were trained in these arts. So if you're missing out on that because you're only focusing on the combat, then what you've got to do is get your head into some resources, into some books. You need to start studying the medieval culture. You need to start reading about medieval battles, medieval people, medieval lifestyle. You've got to, because all of this plays a part. There's so many things which they don't make any sense until, or they make very little sense until you've actually studied it as a whole. And then things just start slotting into place. You understand a whole lot of things. One of the most classic ones, of course, that I encounter a lot is why didn't 14th century knights or feudal knights wearing transitional or plate armour, you know, why didn't they use two weapons? Well, pretty much because if you look at it as a whole, possibly even as earlier on in the 13th century as well, they probably didn't use two weapons all that commonly. They certainly probably didn't train with them. The reason behind that is because they were primarily... They were cavalrymen, so their main weapon was a lance. Now, a lot of people, they're not aware of that. They think the main weapon of a knight is a sword. It is not. That is certainly the most symbolic weapon of a knight, but the primary weapon of a knight is a lance. He employs that from horseback, and then when he dismounts and fights on foot, he's fighting first and foremost with a lance as well. So if we look at that in that context, if that's his primary weapon, he doesn't have a lot of room or a lot of opportunity to use two weapons at once. Now, also, he's got a shield strapped to his left hand, and he needs that to, like on horseback and on foot, to ward off other lance blows which are made against him. If he's got a weapon in that hand, it becomes a little bit more difficult. Finally, to be able to hurt a man wearing that kind of heavy armour, you have to make a fairly fully charged blow. Now, to be able to make a fully charged blow, you pretty much have to put your whole body behind it, or you need two hands behind it. So, again, that pretty much dictates the uselessness of using two weapons in that sort of combat situation. Now, you can also imagine a man on horseback fighting hand-to-hand combat on horseback is going to need one hand somewhat free so he can have a hand on the reins and quite possibly to throw a shield up. Fighting with two weapons on horseback just does not work. You can only attack from one side at any one given time, or you can lean over with your weapon. Generally, it's not very practical though. At least not in that day and age when employed against that sort of armour. Now, it's these sort of things which you're not really going to fully understand until you study everything as a whole. Now, that's the weapons, the armour, the fighting techniques, their culture, their society, and all the rest of that I've already mentioned. So, what I'll do, if you'd like to find out more information on this kind of thing, I would suggest that you head over to the forums at sirjustin.com. And have a look, see there, and I'll post some resources. Or if you want to throw up some questions, open some topics for debate. If you'd like to contest anything that I've said or debate it, and I'm happy for you to do that because I don't know it all, and I'm happy for someone to correct me or bring forward their argument so that we can all better understand these things and all sort of get our heads around a little bit more and appreciate it more and be able to share it with people who are interested. Well, that's about it for our feature for this month. It's a little bit, I feel it's been a little bit rambly, but I just really wanted to get this out pretty quick smart because there's been such a long gap between podcasts. But I do promise that next episode I'll have something a little bit more structured and a little bit more together. And I'd also like to promise that sometime in the future we'll have some more episodes which talk about medieval combat and their specifics, which I think it's a fairly fascinating topic, and it's a topic that really does need addressing in this day and age to set right. And this month we're skipping the medieval marketplace Yes, I know. I can tell everyone's rather disheartened about that. But I do promise it will be back next episode, and hopefully there'll be some fun stuff in there too. I've got some plans for that, so do bear with me. Now we've pretty much reached beyond the 60-minute mark, so I'm going to pretty much wrap it up. But before I do, I'm going to just quickly go through some listener feedback. I've had some. Lots of emails since the last episode. They've slowed down a little bit since I haven't had one out to follow up to keep people interested. But there are a few things I'd like to mention. First of all, is Jim from historyzine.com. He's the he does a podcast called History Zine. You can find that at historyzine.com, and he mentioned the All Things Medieval podcast to a gentleman by the name of Anne at anneisaman.blogspot.com, and Anne actually gave it a review, and it was a fairly favourable review. So I'd like to thank firstly Jim for mentioning that to Anne, and I'd like to thank Anne at anneisaman for doing the review for me. I'm pretty stoked. That's my first review, and I think that's kind of cool. I'm pretty happy about that. I'm also happy with the amount of feedback I've been receiving. It's been really good and really helpful as well. I mean, you guys that are listening, you lords and ladies that have been listening, have been really, really kind and really helpful with suggestions that you've put forward. And there's a whole bunch of you that I'd like to thank. And I'd just like to encourage you to keep communicating with me, keep listening, and keep telling me what you think, whether you agree, whether you disagree, whether I've been wrong on something and you'd like to correct me, or whether I've digressed and haven't gotten to something which I started on, which I know that could be a fair stretch to sort of to think that I'd be capable of doing something like that. But, I don't even remember what I was starting with then. But anyway, thanks for listening to the latest episode, and rest assured that as soon as I close this off and as soon as I get this uploaded, I'm going to be starting on episode number 7, and it's going to be released in the future. So thanks very much for listening, folks, lords and ladies. I bid you salut. Contact All Things Medieval Podcast with your praise, criticisms, suggestions, questions and other feedback at podcast@sirjustin.com. Join in the forums over at sirjustin.com by clicking on the forums tab in the menu. Check out the goods for sale at www.themedievalemporium.com. Music is by Kevin MacLeod, used with permission.